so much of what Paul and I had created unconsciously was congruous with a lot of the anarchist stuff. Number two, I realized, like, wow, this is just like what's now called progressive business. It's just that Emma Goldman was going to jail and Jim Collins is on the bestseller list. But here's a lot of similarities, like self-organizing work teams is a 20th century business term for anarchism. Flattening hierarchy is anarchism. Working with purpose is anarchism. Dignity, anarchism. Diversity, anarchism. Equity, anarchism. So all of these things, which are now commonly discussed in the Harvard Business Review or whatever, every issue is in a different framing what they were trying to do back then.
Welcome to Season 1, Episode 3 of Uncommon Business, the show about unique businesses and leaders who do things differently. I'm Peter.
And I'm Keely.
And we are your hosts. We are also partners at Lumo Group, where we help mission-driven companies plan for the future and execute on their vision. To set the stage for this interview, let's rewind all the way back to 1982. Ronald Reagan was in his first term, the United States was in recession, and the Weather Channel had just launched. In the small college town of Ann Arbor, Michigan, a young man with a Russian history degree co-founded Zingerman's Delicatessen with a friend and a $20,000 bank loan. That man, Ari Weinzweig, is today's guest. Ari opened Zingerman's with just two employees and a small selection of exceptional specialty foods and sandwiches. Today, Zingerman's has developed into a community of 14 different businesses with hundreds of employees and tens of millions of dollars in annual revenues. I first heard about Ari nearly a decade ago when one of my early business mentors told me that I had to read his books. Ari, in addition to being an incredible entrepreneur and leader, is also a prolific writer and author. I actually think of Ari as a philosopher disguised as a business person. Ari has written multiple books about business, leadership, management, and beliefs, and every week he sends out a thoughtful multi-thousand word essay via his newsletter. Through his writing, Ari has inspired thousands of business leaders and employees to think differently about their businesses and their operations. I know this firsthand because earlier in my career, I spent 3 years working for a grocery startup that practiced visioning and open book financial management because the founder of that business had been directly influenced by Ari's work. After following Ari for the better part of the last decade, I was thrilled when I got the opportunity to help Ari and his business partners transition their company to perpetual purpose trust ownership. That process started last year and concluded earlier this year. We discuss the ownership transition during today's interview, but suffice to say, they are one of the higher profile businesses in the country to have made the leap to trust ownership.
Ari is just such a prolific writer and thinker, and has also inspired me for over a decade now. He really feels, both in his writing and in this interview, like the radical college business professor I never had, both because I dropped out of college, but also because all the business professors I did have before I dropped out were not nearly the unconventional thinkers that Ari is. I love that he brings so much outside of the world of business into the way he thinks about business. It's really cool, and I'm excited for folks to hear this interview.
And one more thing before we dive into the interview. Please stay tuned after the episode or after the interview to hear Keely and me debrief our thoughts on the conversation in a more detailed way. And now, my interview with Ari Weinzweig.
Ari, thanks so much for taking time with me today.
My pleasure, sir. Happy to do it.
What did you learn while washing dishes at Mods?
Well, it's a long time ago, Peter. I learned a lot of things, I guess. I learned that I like the food business is the most important. And then I met my business partner, Paul Saginaw, who he had just been promoted from bar manager at one of that restaurant group's other places. And his first day at this place was the same as my first day washing dishes. So I learned about him. And then also Frank Carollo, who retired a few years ago, but was our partner at the bakehouse for whatever, 30 years, was a line cook. And then Maggie Bayless from Zing Train started not long after as a cocktail waitress. So I learned all that. I guess I didn't know anything about food or the food business. I had no aspiration to be in the food business. I just needed a job. So in the context of what I've written about beliefs, I guess I had pretty neutral beliefs about working in restaurants. I didn't know it was bad or good. Didn't know much of anything, but I knew that I had rent coming due and my college roommate was a server in that restaurant and it seemed like he liked it. So I went for it.
At that point in your life, did you have an inkling that you wanted to take an entrepreneurial path and start your own thing?
Peter, I didn't even know what an entrepreneurial path was. There wasn't anybody in my family that was in business. So I forget who says it, but it's sort of like you can't really imagine what you've never experienced. And so, like, I didn't know anybody who had opened a business. I probably did, but I didn't know that I knew anybody who had opened a business. So it wasn't even in my mind. And then also in the context of now in the last 10 years, having studied beliefs a lot, I wouldn't have been able to tell you this all those years ago, but I had very negative beliefs about business. Yeah. I mean, it mostly seemed like it did bad things to people and it didn't seem very interesting. And mostly in my mind, it meant like you put on a suit and went to an office, which sounded terrible or something like that. So it wasn't really in my frame of reference. What was I going to do? I had no idea. Now, I'm a liberal arts major, so I don't know. You go get more degrees, and I didn't know what those degrees were going to be.
You had just come off a degree in Russian history. Is that right?
That's correct, sir, which is a painfully poignant degree to have right now.
Yes. I do want to talk a little bit about that later in the show. So one of the focuses of this podcast is we like to focus on businesses that do things differently, that are unconventional.
And or your poster child.
Exactly. One unconventional thing I noted was that you decided to hire a full-time illustrator in 1991. Can you just tell me about that decision? I think it's...
Well, it was more gradual than that. Like most things, you know, we, as a history person, like we assign a date, but the reality was like the American Revolution didn't happen on the 4th of July. Like it was going on for months and there's parts of the new United States of America that didn't even know that the British had been beaten for many months after that date. But anyway, so when we started, let me back up even further. In part one of the book, which I think you have laying on your table there, the yellow one, it's an essay called 12 Natural Laws of Business. And one of those natural laws is that our strengths lead into our weaknesses and vice versa. So whatever you're really good at will lead to what you're not good at if you follow the continuum. And if whatever you're not good at also offers you the opportunity to have a strength. So when we opened, we had very little money. In those days, computers existed, but they were mostly like a block long and you've booked time ahead of in advance to go work on it. And so getting like a designer or a food photographer or whatever was going to be like $5,000 or something ridiculous. So we didn't have any of that budget. We just had the people who were working make signs, or our friends, or Paul's wife, Lori, did some, or Maggie Bayless, who at the time was going to business school and just coming to help out one day a week, made some, whatever. So that's how we got going. And then I can't remember what year, maybe 1984, 85, Steve Wallach Mino started working at the cheese counter at the deli. He was a photography major, I think, from Michigan State, which is about an hour west of here. His girlfriend at the time, now his wife, was still like a year behind him in school at Michigan. So he moved down here for a year and he got a job. Well, it turned out his handwriting was really great and he had a good design sense, not shocking for a photography major. And so while he was working the counter, he'd make a sign or two. And then as we got busier and we had more products, then he would do a couple hours. And then I don't remember the chronology, but it would be like a day or a half day and then a couple days. And then at some point we made the move to just, it's like, dude, you're really good at this. Why don't we just have you do this all the time? And then he hired an assistant and from there. So yes, that's how it started. And then we also had an illustrator, Ian Nagy, who's still with us, who started around that time that you mentioned. And when we started doing our mail order catalog, it was with illustrations because we couldn't afford food photography.
Yeah.
As per what you would expect, the general wisdom, you like this places that do things differently. The general wisdom was there's no way you're ever going to sell food out of a catalog with drawings. Like, who's going to do that? Of course, now it's our biggest part of our organization. So,
oh, wow. It's like your single biggest source of revenue is that catalog?
The biggest Zingerman's Community of Businesses business is mail order.
Wow. That's
oh, yeah, by yeah. far. Well, it's a bigger market.
Of course. Yeah. That's cool. So a lot of people associate Singerman's, of course, with all this stuff that you've written and visioning and all the stuff that you do differently, open book management. But you started in 1982, but you didn't actually end up writing your mission statement and your guiding principles until a decade later in the early 90s.
Yeah. Can
you just tell me, like, what was happening in your mind that you said at that point, we need to formalize these things?
Yeah. Well, we started as two guys trying to open a business. I mean, there wasn't like this. I mean, from the beginning, we were clear that we only wanted one place. I'm always drawn to the unique places. We knew we wanted something special, so not a copy of San Francisco or LA or Detroit or New York or whatever. We knew we wanted a great place for people to work, a great food experience and a great service experience for our guests, and do it in a very down-to-earth setting. So not sort of, you know, this is fancy food and you need to be fancy, but more like what I really believe still. We believe is everybody can learn to taste good food and experience it in a positive way. So that's how we got going. But it was only me and Paul and two employees. So we had worked for this restaurant group, which was a little more structured, and I'll never live it down, but Maggie will always remind me like of the day where I was like leaning on the sandwich case between the lunch rush and the dinner rush. Remember, we had two people working and me and Paul, that's it. So I was like, God, it's so great to work somewhere where you don't have to write everything down all the time, which of course now is the opposite. But so as a small business, that wasn't inappropriate. But then as we grew, we had 20 people and then 40 people. And then by 1991, when we wrote the mission and the guiding principles, I think we probably had 100 people, something like that. And we, Paul and I, have always been about learning, just like you, and probably just like most everybody listening to this. And there were no podcasts, of course. So we were reading books like I still do. And there's so many great people to learn from, Peter Drucker and Stephen Covey or whoever, you know, was out there, Tom Peters at that time. And somebody that I actually was super skeptical about mission statements. They mostly seemed like they were really bad poetry that was hung by customer bathrooms and seemed relatively pointless to me. But something I read, I think it was a book called Visionary Leadership, I should look it up, is what changed my mind. And so I started to see value. Paul also saw value. And so we commenced the work to write the mission and the guiding principles. And we used a process that we were learning at the time, which now we call bottom line change. It's our organizational change recipe. I did a pamphlet on that. It's basically involving as many people as possible in designing the change before it happens, as opposed to the typical hierarchical model where you and I as bosses figure it out, announce it, and then everybody freaks out. This is where we're all freaking out together. And so it's quite a good process. I would highly recommend it. But anyway, that's when we wrote it. And what inspired me at the time turned out to be hugely helpful, because now I think it's one of the best things we ever did.
Do you have a current favorite guiding principle?
You know, I like them all. The newest pamphlet I did is about food philosophy, which is really just about philosophy. So it's funny that you introduced me as a philosopher, but in the story of how that happened is in the pamphlet. But I think the key is really the holistic nature of it. It's not about singling out one or two things. It's really more clarity around what one's philosophy is, and then immersing oneself deeply in it over a long period of time. And as I came to what I arrived at in working on the food philosophy pamphlet in this conversational context is the mission statement, the guiding principles, and the beliefs. And so that's what you've asked for, is two-thirds of the philosophy. And there's a whole, I just did a whole talk on it at the American Cheese Society last week in Des Moines. I mean, there's many benefits that come from clarity around philosophy in terms of the making decisions, dealing with the 98% of what we do that's pretty gray, not black and white. I think it helps give freedom in the context of anarchism. People can be freed when they understand the philosophy. When they don't understand the philosophy, they get rules. And not that rules are inherently bad necessarily, but if we want people like we do here to break the rules when it's appropriate, you need to have a philosophical grounding in order to be able to figure out when it's the right time to break the rules. And I've come to believe over time it gives you, you develop wisdom from being deeply grounded in the philosophy and practicing it over a long period of time.
You just mentioned you want people to feel comfortable breaking the rules, and they need to be grounded in philosophy in order to do that. I think that's a policy that if a lot of business leaders heard, they would say, okay, that sounds cool in practice, but it sounds scary to implement. If we give people kind of this blank check to just have all, whatever discretion they want, break the rules whenever it feels right, then before we know it, there'll be discounts everywhere and customers will be getting all the special treatment or whatever it is. That policy just kind of naturally worked, or have you had to kind of evolve it or shepherd it or put guardrails around it?
Well, here's what I would say. Here's what I will say. The people you hire are breaking the rules anyway. You just don't always know about it. There's nobody listening to this who hasn't broken a rule. We've all, I don't know, driven over the speed limit. We've all texted during a meeting. We've all done something that everybody, we all know we weren't supposed to do. The philosophy, or in more detail, the mission, the guiding principles, and the beliefs, and we can tie, we have a statement of beliefs that I think that we wrote and approved 2 years ago, which has been awesome. But anyway, helping people to immerse themselves in those, it's not a 2-week process. Like, I can give them the list, but it's like giving a musician the sheet music. It doesn't mean they're going to be in the London Philharmonic next week. I mean, they need time to immerse themselves in the music. And it's way easier if you have the sheet music, but you still need to practice. And then you need to practice in that orchestra, because each orchestra, each conductor, I'm not a musician, but I would imagine that each of them is slightly nuanced in different ways about how they approach it, right? So it's the same here. And this is like helping people have judgment. And people here break the rules regularly, but if they're just breaking the rules randomly with no context, yeah, it's a problem. But if they understand what we're trying to do and they broke the rules with good intentions, in a thoughtful way, I like that problem, because we've all made plenty of bad judgment mistakes over the years.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned the pamphlets, and for people who aren't familiar, in addition to your books, you have dozens of pamphlets that are short and like one topic, and you kind of can read them over, you know, lunch or over an afternoon.
Yeah. So they're, I guess it's 120 years ago now. I used to say 100 years ago, but 120 years ago, pamphlets, my estimation, were essentially the 1900 equivalent of social media. It was one of the quickest ways that you could communicate, that was not just talking one person to another at the local pub, which was also common, but this is where you could write down your ideas, and for a nickel or a dime or quarter or whatever, you could disseminate it quickly, and people often would pass pamphlets from hand to hand. So like that from my anarchist studies. And then just from a practical standpoint, the books are written in, as you know already from having read them, they're written in single essays, are put together in a way that hopefully is coherent and holds together more than just a set of isolated essays. But I tried to put them in there in a way they could stand on their own. So like the mission statement in the writer's fantasy, you sit down and read the whole book, but the real life experience is much more likely like you bought the book, it went on your shelf, which I liked how you have it nicely color coordinated behind you. It goes on your shelf. And then one day your boss goes, "Peter, man, we need a mission statement. Can you get on that?" And you're like, "Yeah, where's that Zingerman's book?" And you don't have time to read the first 200 pages. So you just open, or whatever it is, to the part on mission statements. And I wanted you to be able to like read that clearly, coherently, and figure out what to do. So there's a whole bunch of pamphlets that are single essays from the books. In addition, there's now, 7 pamphlets that are not in the books. So this is single subject things that, and I like it because it allows me to take something on without, a book is a big project. I like it, but it's not as quick. So the newest one is food philosophy. One before that is called The Story of Visioning at Zingerman's. And it's more, I've written a lot, as you know, about visioning, but this is sort of more material, the story of how we learned it, why it's changed our lives. And it's got our current 2032 vision, our previous 2020 vision. And then the one before that, which was the first that we wrote for Zingerman's 2009, and we wrote that in 94. So that's out. And there's 5 other ones, one on humility, one about Emma Goldman, the anarchist, that you might want to ask me about later. I don't know. One about is The Art of Business, which is my belief that business and life are like art or music. And the more we would think that way, the more interesting work we would do. One is The Bottom Line Change Process, which I just mentioned. And then I think last but not least is Working Through Hard Times, which was sort of written about the pandemic and getting through it. And I just wrote it halfway through the pandemic, because most history is written from afterwards, and I wanted to write it from in it. Of course, it's not the only hard time any of us are going to go through, so the ways that we got through are universally applicable. So that's what the pamphlets are.
I mean, you hinted at it, but there's a bit of an anarchist history.
Yes. So anarchists use pamphlets quite a bit. That's where I first came across them in abundance, was at the Labadie collection in the Graduate Library of the University of Michigan, which is really, I think, the largest collection of anarchist material in the country. And I used to go up there and study as part of my history work. I really loved it. And part of what I was drawn to a lot with the anarchists was a lot of the ideology, the philosophy, the ideas, but they also were very much into art and beauty and poetry and stuff. So it wasn't just that there was interesting ideas printed on mimeograph or whatever that was also up there, but there were also these ones that were like beautifully designed and great art and some amazing artists, Louis Moreau and John Buckland Wright and people who are still pretty obscure, but they were doing really remarkable work. And so not only did these pamphlets sound good, but they actually looked good too. And I was always drawn to them. I just think from a practical standpoint, like there's some people like me that really want a book, but there's a lot of people who see a big book and they freak and they're just no way, but they'll be happy to take a 20-page, 40-page, whatever pamphlet and get it done, as you said, in a much quicker setting. And then when I also liked it, because when everybody started getting Kindles, I'm like, it's actually lighter than an e-reader.
Yeah, right. Take it back.
Take it on the plane, man.
Yeah. So we're talking about anarchism, but for people who are familiar with what that means, what does it mean to be an anarchist? And specifically, what are some common misconceptions about anarchy and anarchists that you'd like to know?
So I think it's highly misunderstood. When January 6th happened, people were like, it's anarchism. It's like, no, this is the opposite of anarchy. It's nihilism, which comes from the 19th century Russian nihilist, Sergei Nechayev, and the organization that followed his principles, Narodne Volya, or People's Will, who assassinated Tsar. I just happened to look this up again the other day, so it's fresh in my mind, but Alexander II. But anyway, nihilism is where you're just opposed to everything and it can be violently applied. Anarchism has certainly been applied by some in a violent way, but so has Christianity, capitalism, Judaism, and Islam, and everything else. So I guess I wouldn't say that all people who believe Christians are doomed forever to be assigned to the bloody wars of the Crusaders, or that everybody who practices Islam should be judged by the people who initiated 9/11 or whatever. Like, these are people on an extreme, and there's a lot more to it than that. When I studied anarchism in school when I was much younger, I was drawn to it, I think, for many reasons. I liked a lot of the ideas. I liked the encouragement to be oneself and not get caught up in social pressure to conform, which is always a problem and a challenge. I liked that it was free thinking. I liked the art and all of that. So there were a lot of things I liked. That said, in hindsight, when I was in school, I was probably much more focused on what I would now call freedom from. Like, you can't make me do this, and my mother can't make me do this, and whatever. So I liked anarchism. When I graduated and got my dishwashing job that you asked about, it was far from my mind. And when we started in business, I wasn't really reading anarchists. I was reading Peter Drucker. And so it really wasn't in my head at all. And so for years, when I would speak, I would tell my story, and I would say I was a lapsed anarchist because I still believed in it, but I didn't practice. And I had tried in my early days of managing people to leave them all alone in the belief they would just do the right thing. And of course, that didn't work at all. And so that's why I started to say I was a lapsed anarchist. I think it's probably 14 or 15 years ago. She was just in for dinner at the Roadhouse the other night. Deborah Dash Moore, the head of the Jewish Studies Department, asked me to come speak over there. And I'd been speaking at a lot of business conferences and food conferences and stuff, but not at Jewish studies. And she goes, I'm going to call it like rye bread on anarchism on rye or something, because I had just written this long essay on the history of Jewish rye bread. And I thought, well, that's cute. Sounds good, whatever. But a lot of academic talks, it was booked like 11 months in advance or 9 months. So I wasn't really that worried about it. But when I got about 2-3 months out, I'm like, oh man, I'm going to look like an idiot, because it's been 25 years since I read any of this stuff. And she titled it Anarchism. And I mean, I kind of know the name still, but I'm really out of touch. I better start reading again. So I got all my old books out and I started to reread them. And it blew my mind for two reasons. Number one, so much of what Paul and I had created unconsciously was congruous with a lot of the anarchist stuff. Number two, I realized, like, wow, this is just like what's now called progressive business. It's just that Emma Goldman was going to jail and Jim Collins is on the bestseller list. But here's a lot of similarities, like self-organizing work teams is a 20th century business term for anarchism. Flattening hierarchy is anarchism. Working with purpose is anarchism. Dignity, anarchism. Diversity, anarchism. Equity, anarchism. So all of these things, which are now commonly discussed in the Harvard Business Review or whatever, every issue is in a different framing what they were trying to do back then. So let me answer the misconception is that anarchism is about throwing rocks and violence. It's not. As Alexander Berkman, Emma Goldman's longtime friend, lover, and colleague over decades said in the famous quote, which I can only paraphrase, he said, actually, anarchism is the exact opposite of that. It's about love. It's about care, etc. Anarchism, I came to understand even better about 10 years ago when I was reading Gustav Landauer, who was a pacifist German anarchist in the early 20th century. He was kicked to death by the German army in 1919. But he said, we have no political beliefs. We have beliefs against politics. And as the light bulb went off, and I was like, oh yeah, it's the opposite of politics. It's not about replacing the current government. It's a way of life and it's a belief system. And then Howard Ehrlich, who passed away 7 or 8 years ago, who lived in Baltimore, paraphrasing, but he said, who will make the anarchist revolution? And then his answer is you and me right now. And it's all about how I treat you and how I treat everybody I work with. So there's quite a few essays in the books. Secret 43.5 is in part four, is my beliefs about business and anarchism. And one of them is, you know, learning to not think hierarchically. That's a big one, right? So people are so used to thinking hierarchically that most people don't even know they're doing it. But it's the belief there's one answer. It's the belief there's a most important thing. It's the belief that if you're the boss, you must be better essentially than the person who's, you know, doing the deliveries. It means that if you're the quarterback, you're probably better than the guy on the bench. And you might be better at your skills, but it doesn't make you a better person. And it doesn't mean that that player or that other person doesn't know as much as you do. They just know different things. So it's getting out of hierarchical thinking, et cetera. So that's a long answer, but there you go.
And I think you used a term at some point in your writing, anarcho-capitalism.
I didn't really fully know that it was already in use by people whose approach I don't agree with. They're much more what I would say are, in my language, are libertarian. It's a lot of freedom from. And I arrived 10 or 15 years ago with freedom too. So freedom too means what's true for me. I have the choice to work hard for the community. I have a choice, I'm sure we'll get to it, to essentially gift the business to the people who work here and to itself through a perpetual purpose trust. We have the choice to be kind. We have the choice to do the right thing for those around us. And nobody's making me do it. I'm not doing it out of obligation. I'm doing it because I believe it's the right thing to do. I don't feel put upon. I feel freely choosing that. The anarchism is really all about organization. This is another common misconception, is anarchism equals chaos. It's the opposite. It's all about organization. It's just that you're involving the people in the organization, in the organizing, as opposed to the people at the top, in quotes, figuring it all out for them on the belief that the other people are too dumb to be able to do anything. So it's not opposed to leadership. It's just leadership that's dignity-based and where I don't have the belief I'm any better than the person we just fired last week.
Right. So you kind of hinted at maybe a psychic difference of libertarians versus anarchists and freedom from versus freedom to. But if you were to try to distinguish those, because I think for the layperson, they might sound similar. Yeah. How would you?
Oh, they're pretty different. So, and again, like there's no anarchism of all subjects. There's no universal truth. This is my truth. And I don't even know that I would say I'm an anarchist. I just am drawn to a lot of anarchism and a lot of anarchist beliefs. But it's always about adapting. But as I would frame it, not judging people who are libertarians, but it's much more like, I can have a gun, you can't stop me, I shouldn't have to pay taxes, I can drive 80 through the neighborhood, I don't have to wear a mask when there's COVID, whatever.
Right.
This is much more about community. It's about collaboration. It's about treating everybody with dignity. Like, you could have the freedom to do those things that I just described. But if you don't treat everybody with dignity as if they're your equal, then it's not that helpful.
Yes.
So this is really how we work together in a dignified way, where we're creating a setting where people have a say in what's going on in a meaningful way, and where we're not thinking or acting hierarchically or parentally or patriarchally. It's more like, okay, dude, I don't know what I'm doing. You don't know what you're doing. I got strong feelings about this. You have different feelings. Let's figure it out. And yes, there is operational hierarchy, just like the quarterback ultimately calls the play, just like the orchestra conductor ultimately sets the pace for the orchestra. But this framing leads us to understand that the orchestra conductor might be world class, but they're not any better than the carried the bass drum in. They're just different.
Yeah. And it creates more of a foundation for mutual respect between all the players.
Absolutely. And so things like mutual aid, which got a lot of press during the pandemic, comes from Peter Kropotkin's book, Mutual Aid, written in 1902. He was an anarchist also who fled Russia, gave up his nobility and his title, went to jail, escaped prison in Siberia, got out and became a really well-known naturalist, geographer and scientist, and studied nature and found the opposite of Thomas Hobbes' argument for the war of all against all. He found that the most collaborative were the most successful. The ones who were engaged in mutual aid were the fittest, right? So the more you helped people, the fitter you were, the better you did. And yeah. So he said, yes, natural selection is correct, but it's not war of all against all. It's who helps who. And that's been proven to be true. Adam Grant's book, Give and Take, is a modern version of it, in my opinion. But the fact that it's been proven to be true doesn't change people's belief. And they still say it's a war of all against all because it's been so commonly used for so many centuries now.
Yes. If we ever have an apocalypse or an apocalyptic moment, it's you're not going to want to have the most guns. You're going to want to have the best community.
Correct. Just like the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've mentioned her name a couple of times. I think you need to tell us a little more about Emma Goldman.
I'd be glad to. So Emma Goldman was born in 1869, if my memory's right, in Lithuania. And she came here to the U.S. when she was like 16 in 1885. And let's say by the time she was 20, 19, 21, whatever, she was speaking to an audience of 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people, which in those days was pretty much all men who you would have been speaking to. She was about 5 feet tall. And this is, of course, hard for us to remember, but there was no PA system.
Right.
So that's a pretty powerful to be 5 feet tall woman commanding an audience of 4,000 or 5,000 men without a PA system. This kind of tells you something.
I'd love to see a video of that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's a few you can find when she was older, but I don't think it conveys the power of a 20. It's without getting into politics. It reminds me a little of like AOC because she was young and not coming out of formal training in politics. And yet she had this presence around her, intelligence and ability to use wit and insight quickly. And Emma Goldman was very funny and very, very smart. Anyway, she was an anarchist and she wrote a lot and she did a lot. She went to jail more often than not for standing up for women's rights and reproductive freedom 120 years ago than she did for anything else. But she was quite a powerful leader. J. Edgar Hoover, the infamous FBI director, called her the most dangerous woman in America. In 1919, I think, she was deported from the U.S. because she had opposed World War I and the draft, and they sent her back to the Russian Empire, whence she had come so many decades earlier after living in the U.S. for 30 years. And she arrived, they sent her back because, of course, this was a year or two after the Russian Revolution. So in theory, it was supposed to be nirvana, but anarchism and Marxism are antithetically opposed to each other. This is another thing people don't understand, but anarchism and communism is not at all the same thing. And anyway, within a year, she was very disenchanted and upset and warning of the dangers of Leninism and Marxism, and now today, Putinism. In 1923, I think she wrote a book called My Disillusionment with Russia. which of course we could change to 1923 to 2023, and it would update the language, and it's the same book. So anyway, I just think she was very insightful, and her push against government, which was a common push of anarchism, I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's not my push. I got bigger issues than government, and I don't know how to run a country without one. So my thing is to focus on anarchism in a daily way to live, right? How do we run the organization better, et cetera? And so the pamphlet, Going into Business with Emma Goldman, I wrote for her in honor of her 150th birthday. And it's a little bit of business sci-fi, so to speak, because her and Alexander Berkman in, I think, 1891 or two or something like that, had a cafe in Worcester, Massachusetts for like 4 months. And they decided to sell it to go back to New York to be more active in fighting against whatever. But the thing was like, you know, what if they would have just kept it and they could have made a lot of headway, and they might have had like what we have, an right. organization of equitably oriented businesses. So anyway, that's what it is. It's all these lessons that you could use in your business.
For people, including me, who want to learn more about Emma Goldman, is there a book you'd recommend?
That's a good place to start. Going into Business with Emma Goldman, that I wrote. It's one place. I mean, I like her writing and I reference it. And I think I have a reading list in the back of the pamphlet. Her autobiography is very long and not the easiest read.
Okay.
If I were going to pick one of her works, I would read Anarchism and Other Essays, which came out in like 1910. That's a lot of what influenced me quite a bit.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, pivoting a little bit, I want to talk about failure a little bit.
But don't screw it up.
People, of course, know a lot about Zingerman's because of your successes and your many businesses that have done well and the books that have been popularized and have applied lessons to businesses around the country. But what are some things that you've tried and failed at as a business? And if you have a favorite failure, something that really stands out for you, that'd be great.
I don't have a favorite failure. So in the spirit of what I was saying about hierarchy, as you know, a lot of the newer work I'm doing, which is only minimally published in the book, part four, but I'm working on a pamphlet slowly but surely, and then a book hopefully after that, but is the idea of an organizational ecosystem as a metaphor for organizations. Mm-hmm. And in nature, like in a healthy garden or forest, their success and failure are happening simultaneously. It's not like you're a success or you're a failure. Like every second, there's something going right and there's something going wrong. And it's often on the same tree or the same plant or whatever. So my girlfriend's a farmer. Like she could have planted 100 tomato plants and 97 are doing well and 3 aren't. Or you could have a plant with healthy, beautiful tomatoes, but 3 tomatoes come out shriveled. I don't know. You know, it's... So I'm much more focused on the small failures, which happen constantly. Even while I'm sitting here with you, there's 38 things have gone wrong probably in the last 40 minutes since we started talking. If we prevent the small things from going wrong / keep the good small things going right, then the big problems don't happen. The press likes to report on the big failures, but it's getting dated. But Enron as a giant ethical failure. Like, it's not like everything was going great and then one day they stole a lot of money.
Right.
It's not like BP or whoever had the problem with the Gulf oil. Like, it's not like they were operating totally in ethical frame all the time and then one guy made one or one woman made one bad decision. It's that we're leaning towards these problems over and over again. We don't do the right thing on Monday. We cut corners on Tuesday. We short arm something on Wednesday. And 5 years later, there's a headline in the New York Times business section. I guess for me, I'm much more focused on that. Everything you can imagine, pretty much we've screwed up. I mean, everything I write about is mostly learned from what we screwed up or I screwed up personally.
Yeah. So what's an example of, say, a little thing that you might focus on or that you focused on recently?
Well, it's could be as simple as we didn't greet the guest with enough enthusiasm. It could be that we have a sign that doesn't really sound compelling in its sign copy. The espresso was only a 7.5 out of 10, not a 9 out of 10, thousands of them. And they're all important. It's no different than in farming, like the little things that people do as a farmer that enhance the health of the soil. The casual observer won't even notice it, but it will manifest later in the health or lack of health in the plant.
If you notice, or some other leader at your organization notices that one of the staff members isn't greeting guests enthusiastically. Yeah. Like, what do they do? Like, what is the Zingerman's way of approaching
that? We yell at them and humiliate them in front of the customer.
Yeah.
Well, it's a craft, not a science. So in the right setting, it might be appropriate to just gently say something in the moment. Sometimes, though, it's really busy and I could see they're having a bad day. And if I'm on top of my game, which I'm not always, then I keep my mouth shut and I wait for a more appropriate time. It could be a good technique is asking them how they think it's going, because they might say, you know, I haven't been very enthusiastic today. My cat is sick and I'm really stressed out. Okay, well, that's helpful. If they know it wasn't going well, it's far more powerful if they acknowledge it than if they only hear it from me. So, you know, it could be that we haven't trained them well. It could be that they were trained well, but they're not implementing it well. It could be that whatever, they were trained a year ago and they're not focused, and we need to help them refocus on the job expectations. So any or all of those together could work.
Yeah.
And more.
So I don't know if you remember this, but so one thing I should note for listeners and readers who aren't aware, but you put your email address in your books and all over the place. If people want to reach you, they can. Mm-hmm. And my partner, Keely Tillotson, back when she was running a company called Wild Friends Nut Butter, she reached out to you via email. You picked
that's
up
your partner?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's you picked
tell her I said hi.
I will. And you picked up the phone and you called her a day or two later to answer her question, which she was very impressed by. And I guess my question is, I'm sure you get a lot of outreach. So how do you sustain this level of availability to the many people who admire Zingerman's in your work?
Well, I would say far less people use it than you think. So it's sort of like why bosses don't let people break the rules because they're so afraid of it. And then they make more rules and then people break the rules just because they're pissed at the boss. Whereas if you tell them to break the rules, our problem is more that they don't break the rules enough than that they break them too much. I did write an essay on time management that's in Managing Ourselves, the green book there on your table. I guess I just think that people, and I wrote about it in the beliefs book too, like people have negative beliefs about email. And if you have negative beliefs, it's not going to go well. And my experience is people spend more time complaining about answering email than it takes to answer the email. Number one. Number two, I have the positive beliefs that, like, I'm going to learn from Keely. Maybe it's a great product. Maybe there's a Zingtrain client. Maybe she knows some cool stuff. Little did I know I would meet you all these years later, you know. And so it's going into it with the belief that good things could come from it, and that if I don't have the conversation, my life isn't going to collapse the next day. But these are the little things. They're small successes. And I leave the conversation energized, both from learning her story in that case, and also potential upside for me. Maybe, like I said, maybe we find a new product, maybe we have a connection that's of value. It's funny, but I think Adam Grant, who is a Michigan graduate, and we email now and again, and he does great work. And I think he does the same thing, gives it out. And I gave my email out, Paul, my business partner, and I spoke at the U of M, that's University of Michigan, commencement in 2015. I didn't even go to my own graduations, but somewhat begrudgingly, I went to them. I gave my email out from the stage to 50,000 people, and I offered to all of the graduates that mentioned vision, like the most powerful tool that I've learned, probably, or one of them, is clearly visioning. I had known about visioning when I was 18 or 20 or even 8 or 10. And so I said, okay, the best gift I know that I could give you is I'll talk to you about visioning because it changed my life. So any graduate that me, which was like, I don't know, 6,000-7,000 people, I'll meet with you and I'll help you.
Right.
Okay. So how many did I get? I think I might be up to 14.
Wow, that's crazy.
I got more from people's parents. And I'm like, well, the offer wasn't for you. The offer is for your kid. You can buy the book.
People often forget that there's actual humans on the other side of newsletters or books, you know, authors. Yeah. And so, I mean, a good example of what you do is Seth Godin, who I know you know. And Seth, obviously, he writes his daily blog. He has millions of followers. But I think people forget that they can just click reply and it's actually Seth. Yeah. I've replied multiple times and Seth always emails back, which
like very quickly.
Very quickly.
It makes me look slow. So I'll tell you a funny story is like, cause so with the books where we didn't really gotten into it, but we're kind of off the grid. So one of the key learnings that I had from Anarchism is that the means that you use, this was a big Emma Goldman thing, the means that you use. So the way you go about doing the work needs to be congruous or aligned with the outcome that you're trying to attain. So when you ask what we do if a staff member doesn't greet somebody, well, I jokingly said we humiliate them. But, and of course we don't. I mean, I can't say I've never done it by accident, but it's certainly not my intent or what we would do. So, however, it's quite common in businesses that are not thinking this way that the leader will yell at the employee for giving bad service. It's not congruous.
Yes.
It doesn't work. So with the books, after a short experience with or a single experience with large publishing, I realized it was incongruous with our values. So like they're trying to sell, they were like worried about the price point of the book. And I'm like, that's not our customers. Like make a nicer book and charge more. Like I want a great book that feels good in your hand. Anyway, so it didn't go that great. And the way that the people were interacting, communicating was not aligned with our values. And I'm like, this is very stressful.
Yeah.
It's not helpful. We made the decision to go back to self-publishing and then said, with respect to all my friends who buy from Amazon, I've only purchased very minimally because for me, it's like an invasive species and it seems incongruous with the kind of work that you do and that we do. And I don't understand why everybody's for sustainable local business, but then they order off of Amazon because it's convenient and cheaper. And it's like, so we don't sell the books are on Amazon through a reseller that we can't stop from doing it, but I think they're more expensive on Amazon.
Yeah, which I think they are. Have.
Yeah. And so we're like farm to table for books. And so it allows us a way to interact. So the story is because we're farm to table, I see when the orders come in a good way. Like, and I don't answer everybody, but sometimes I look them up or I thank you note when I got 10 minutes and I'm not sure what to do. I'll just like pull up the orders and I start writing thank you notes. And one time I wrote one to a guy who I now know named Daryl Dash, who's a minister and does very nice work in Toronto. And so I sent him an email, I think it was in January, and it was like, thanks so much for ordering the book the other day. You know, if I can ever be a help, let me know. We're only 4 hours away, whatever. I never heard back from him, which isn't the only time, whatever. And then like a year later, he emailed me unrelated to that. Like, and I'm like, God, I could swear I remember that name, Daryl Tatch. So I look it up and I answered his, I think he was asking for something that I had offered somewhere in an article anyway. So I said, I feel like I emailed you like a year ago, but I realized I never heard back. And, you know, I miss them too, but I just thought that was like an auto response or some assistant answering. I'm like, no, it was me.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. That's funny. And so for Pete, because you're talking about farm to table book, just if people are watching the video.
Yeah.
These are very nicely done, self-published. Like they feel good in your hands. They have the nice color, all sorts of stuff.
We print them here in town too.
Cool. Because he came up, I guess I'll ask, what's one thing you've learned from Seth Godin?
Well, I learned a lot about marketing. His new book is very aligned with our work. And I actually wrote a whole piece about him and Emma Goldman together, because although she wouldn't have thought of herself as marketing, she was marketing ideas. And that's really what he does too. And years ago, long before I knew him, I work around differentiation and don't just follow the pack and purple cow. And it's all right on. I mean, I think that his take on not just doing what everybody else is doing and that the quality of your product is marketing and that you need to be true to who you are is all right on. And his book, The Practice, which, you know, you mentioned the e-news and that I'll be up early tomorrow working on it, get it out every week. And he has the same kind of rigor around doing his blog post every day. We have a lot of shared values. And in the beginning of our work, he was really one of the most inspiring people around the idea of marketing and how it relates to business. And the idea that marketing is leadership, not advertising, is something that he's not the only one I learned it from, but he's one of the more prominent ones. I really respect his ability to walk his own path and, to your point, stay human and kind in the process. It's not that common.
Yeah. I always tell people who are allergic to marketing or think marketing is spammy or scammy just to go read Seth, and it will change their mind about how they should think about
that. Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
The means being incongruous with the ends or congruous with the ends.
Yeah.
Just also made me think about parenting. I have a 2-year-old, and just you start to realize the truth of that statement as you learn how to communicate with a 2-year-old. And I mean, I think of all ages, but you can't show up with like a harsh tone. If you expect, you show up with love, if you want the end result to be kind of a loving, peaceful situation.
Yep.
So visioning is something that you're very well known for. You've mentioned it before. Let's talk a little bit about it. What is a vision, and how is it different than, say, a strategic plan, which is something maybe more familiar with?
Yeah. So vision, I would say the vision is the story of your future written in the present tense as if it's already happened. And that could be your future for your relationship with your child 10 years from now. Could be a vision for a business. It could be a vision for a change that you're making. It could be a vision for your vacation. One starts using it extensively, it shows up everywhere. Part of what happens in a good way to people who are here for a while is they also start working that way. It's essentially Stephen Covey's begin with the end in mind, but in a systemic and far more detailed way than just thinking about it, which isn't unhelpful, but it's more powerful, I have found, to write it down, especially in a group. So if you have a small group, it's not uncommon that through conversation, you share the vision. But when you have multiple people involved, we all have our own vision and we tend to change it from time to time. The process, as we learned it, and is described, as I said, in the Story of Visioning pamphlet. Paul and I learned it in 1993 from Stash Kazmierski, who sadly passed away 5 years ago in May. Stosh had learned it essentially from Ron Lippitt, who was at the Institute of Social Research in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s. He had done work with Kurt Levine and many other progressive social scientists and was part of the National Training Labs in Maine, which in social scientist history was quite a think tank, so to speak. Anyway, Ron Lippitt's work was based mostly on nonprofit work. He called it preferred futuring, as I have written and as we learned it from Stosh. So essentially, as I understand it, because I wasn't there, but Ron Lippitt, you know, they would go do like community work. How do we make this community better? And, you know, somebody would have an idea and somebody else would have an idea. And by the third or fifth or sixth idea, somebody would start going, well, you're never going to get the budget for that. And we tried that 10 years ago and the mayor's never going to approve that, or the zoning board. And so people's energy in the beginning might increase, but then it started to plateau. And then by the time all the naysaying happened, people would leave more pessimistic and cynical than they had been when they arrived and very discouraged. So Ron Lippitt, what I would say his genius to me was that he said, forget about how we get there. Just plant your brain in the future, so to speak, and describe what success looks like in a way that pretty much everybody gets most of what they want. And he called it preferred futuring. We adapted it from Stosh, what we learned from Stosh with Stosh's help. And we called it visioning because it was about writing the vision of the future that you wanted. So a strategic plan, as we look at it, is how you get to the vision. But the vision is where you're going. As Stosh taught us, and as we still say, the vision is the what. What success will look like. Strategic plan is how you get to success. The common problem is people are taught to do strategic plans, but they don't know where the hell they're going.
Yeah.
So it makes no sense.
So to be clear, at Zingerman's, do you, in addition to your visioning, do you also do strategic planning?
We do planning, but we don't start the plan till we know where we're going.
Right.
And when I teach it, I'm like, you could try it as soon as we get off and you go, Keely, pack, we're going to leave tomorrow. What's the first thing she's going to ask you?
Yeah. Well, what are we doing? Where are we going?
Where are we going? Right. Because if you're coming to Ann Arbor in February, it's totally different than if you're going to Arizona in August. Right. So depending on where you want to go, it alters the plan. And then the plan is done much closer to the moment because it allows you to adjust to things like pandemics, stock market crashes, big storms, whereas the vision is one of the key parts of what we do that's different is the vision is an inside out exercise. It's not an exercise in what you could do, what you should do, what your competitors do, what your mother wanted or your business professor wanted or your cousin wants. It's what you want. And so there's not a right or a wrong vision, right? So our vision is that we only open in the Ann Arbor area, that we only open each business once. Now through the perpetual trust, purpose trust, our vision is it'll never be sold, et cetera. Other people have completely different visions. Like the only reason they started the business was to sell it and make a lot of money. And from the get-go, their intent was to open as many of their units as they could all over the world.
And so you do your visions, you have a long-term vision. Like right now you're working on your Zingerman's 2032 vision.
Yep.
And when was that one written?
So that one is a good story, which is told in the pamphlet, but it was, we had one for 2020 that we wrote in 2007. So when we got to, I don't know, 2018, it was almost there and we started the work. And the way we work is we make organization-wide decisions. So not like what the price of, you know, the goat cream cheese at the creamery is, that's decided at the creamery. But what if we were approving a new vision, it's going to be decided by consensus of our partners group, which right now includes 22 people. So in a good way, it's not a quick process. And then because we're using our bottom line change recipe, it's about involving as many people as possible. So it's not just you and I climb Mount Sinai and come back with the vision. It's going to be, here's our draft, but now we're going to get input. Let's rewrite it. Okay, now we share another draft. So anyway, we started the work in 2018 after countless drafts, discussions, disagreements, coming back to the table over and over. We pretty much finalized it. And the meeting, the huddle where we were going to share it was scheduled for the end of March 2020.
And we all know about March 2020.
So that didn't happen.
Yeah.
It wasn't really for front of mind for the next few months, whatever April, May people that I knew who know that we do visioning and that we had just finished working on this new vision would be talking to them. And they're like, well, I guess you're going to have to change that vision. I guess you have to rewrite that vision. And I started to freak out and like, oh my God, what do we do? Like, we just spent 2 years working on this. We're going to have to change everything. And I went back and reread it. I'm like, there's nothing to change. Like, it's the same. And you could have a pandemic, but it doesn't change what you want your life to be like in 2032. Right. And so, whereas a strategic planning mindset, it's not inherently incompatible with a vision, but the way it's practiced is much more like, you're the boss, we're going this way. Now I'm the boss, we're going that way. Our competitor just did this, we should do this. I saw this article, we should do this. So it's much more like sort of, I won't say random because it's thoughtful, but it's not headed towards the same place. This is where you've decided how you want to live. So like I said, that's our vision is to only open here, but other people's vision is to go national and open as many units as they can. They're both okay. It's just, if you don't know where you're going, it's very hard to plan. And if you're only reacting to opportunities and problems as life presents them, it's a very, I would suggest, haphazard way to approach what you're doing.
And so you have the vision, and then at what time increments is your planning process?
Well, we've been annual. We made a push to change to quarterly, and now we're in not full alignment as to what's better.
Interesting. So you're figuring that out right now. Is that the partner group figuring that out, or who's in that conversation?
Well, there's a bunch of people, including the partner group, because we're the accountants, there's other key people. A lot of this is disruption from the pandemic and trying to re-piece things together. We'll figure it out.
I just was talking to, for this podcast a couple of days ago, Jason Fried, who is author, and he wrote Rework, and he's the founder of Basecamp, the project management software. They work, not that this is necessarily applicable to...
Helpful.
But they work in 6-week cycles. And so they never know what they're doing more than 6 weeks out. And they have 6-week cycles. And then at the end of 6 weeks, they have a 2-week cool down period where they kind of figure out what they're going to do for the next 6 weeks. And during the cool down period, people like still have work to do, but it's more just like maintenance work and stuff like that. So yeah, it's an interesting and unique process for sure.
So 6 weeks, then 2 weeks to think about it. Yeah. See, we're in a business where every minute you're waiting on people and making things.
Yeah. A little bit different. Yeah. What he likes about 6 weeks is it's long enough to do something meaningful, but short enough where from the beginning, you kind of feel the urgency of having to get it done. So
yeah, no, that's what I like about the quarterly. What's been hard though is there's some things that are ideal for the quarterly for all those reasons. Mm-hmm. Then there's some things that take a lot longer. And I get it that you can still have it in your goals, but it's like, because we've done open book management, we've been historically over the whatever decades of doing it, like you agree on where you're going for the year with your numbers. Like it's not a prediction. It's where you want to be. It's a leadership act, like marketing with Seth Godin. So like we want to build sales to this level, right? Well, then when you're off course, you better start scrambling. Like if you're playing basketball and you're down 20 at halftime, you got your work cut out for you, but you could still do it. But the problem when it's only quarterly is if you're halfway through the quarter and you're behind a lot, like it's hard to set a bolder goal when it's only 12 weeks away.
Right. Yes. I suppose that's maybe one of the differences is with Basecamp and with Jason Fried's company, they actually don't set goals. They don't even really have targets. They completely avoid revenue targets, things like that. Uh-huh. And instead they just focus on kind of the outcomes they want. And they assume naturally that revenue profit will flow from that. Of course, one big difference is they're in a very high margin software business. It's not quite the penny business of running.
Yeah. A lot of work is based on what the sales forecasts are. So like how many people you need to work is totally different if your sales forecast is higher or lower. And sales being 10% down or 10% up could be the difference between losing money and making money.
Yeah, no, I mean, these are good points that I've been thinking about for the work we do here at Lumo Group with helping people with planning, like what sorts of frameworks map on to different industries or different types of companies, because there's not a one size fits all necessarily.
Yeah, well, I'll be interested in what you come up with. We're still trying to figure it out.
So you're also a proponent of writing, as you kind of hinted at, not just for the business, but of writing like a personal vision of greatness. And I'm curious, do you have a current personal vision for 2030?
I don't, and I need to get one. I'm overdue to write one with my girlfriend again, just like whatever, everybody falls short. I'm now no different than everybody else in that sense. But I guess what I would say is that we use it as much as possible for everything. My belief, which I've written a lot about in the books, it's a natural human process. Like everybody's born, your two-year-old knows how to do this. They imagine all kind of stuff.
Right.
At four, like when they're five, you come home from work and while you were gone, they made a restaurant in the living room. And as I always say, like they didn't do I-9s on the stuffed animals. They didn't do a business plan. They didn't do market comps. They just opened it. And then by 8 o'clock that night, they closed it. They threw the stuffed animals in the corner. They didn't do any proper layoffs or any kind of counseling or anything. They just did it. So we all know how to do this, but we get put in settings that there's so much pressure to conform. And we all experience it. I mean, I think that's part of what drew me to anarchism when I was younger, is like, didn't like the pressure to conform. And so we forget how to do it. Like every six-year-old knows how to vision, but at 26, we're going like, well, I read this book and I think I could do this, but then I saw that maybe I should do this. And I don't know, maybe I should be a teacher, but maybe I should, there's a million, you know, like we can overthink everything. And so the visioning work is great for everything, right? So I always say, like, if you're going on vacation, you and Keely are going to Paris. She's like, we're so excited, we're going to Paris. So like, if you go with me to Paris, it's going to be like, great, all these restaurants picked. Here's the stores I want to go to. And then there's like these six markets. And I was thinking Tuesday afternoon, we might be able to stop by the Louvre for an hour. If you go with somebody else, it'll be like, I don't care where we eat. There's a McDonald's down the road, but I got these like 17 museums we're going to. So they're both totally legit. It's just different visions of the same 7-day period.
Totally.
What I would suggest is that most of us are raised to think of what's wrong and or who's in the way of us getting done what we want to get done. And it's mostly negative thinking. So visioning is positive beliefs about the future, positive beliefs about yourself. And through what we now know, and I'm certainly not a scientist, but what now everybody's paying attention knows about neuroplasticity. If you do the visioning work regularly over 2 or 3 or 4 years, like your brain changes, like you just start going immediately unconsciously to what you want. And culturally, people will do it to me. Like I forget to write a vision and somebody will go like, you know, I'll be like going, we need to do this or we need to do that. And they're like, well, where's your vision, dude? And I'm like, oh yeah, I didn't write a vision. You know, so culturally, we self-correct, and then ultimately it becomes a way of being in the world, which is a far more positive, proactive, forward-thinking, self-directed way to be. And everybody wants to be like that. Like nobody writes a vision that says, I'm reactive. You know, my parents still tell me what to do, and I kind of just follow along with the pack. Like, nobody wants that.
Yeah. And then for people who aren't as familiar with the visioning process, and I'll include links and to the books, you mentioned this already about writing in the present tense, but you would write something like, it's summer 2030 and here I am, Ari, I'm sitting on my back deck. Yeah. And
if you're an English major, which I wasn't, so I didn't know this, but it's basically free writing. If you're an engineer, it might paralyze you. I'm stereotyping, which I don't like to do, but for people who are used to figuring out all the details before they finalize anything, it's awkward. For people who are used to free writing, it seems totally natural and normal, but it works for everybody. It just may take some people longer to get used to it than others. I didn't take to it that quickly. I'm definitely from the upbringing of, I would never tell you what I really wanted till I was pretty confident I could actually get there. The other way, this is where you're going to sit down and you're going to write whatever. It's September 2024. Our trip to Paris was awesome. We really had a great time. We bonded. We did a lot of walking. You know, we saw these three cafes. We stumbled on these other ones. We ran into some people, you know, whatever, like it's your story. But my friend Gareth Higgins, whose books I would highly recommend, his hometown of Belfast right now, he says this, and I quoted this in the Story of Visioning pamphlet, but he says the story that we tell ourselves about our lives is the most important contributor to the quality of our life. So if the story that we're telling, it's going to be a negative life. You can see this playing out, with all due respect, politically in the country right now. If the story is the country sucks, we're doomed, the government sucks, it's hopeless, we're screwed, they're taking advantage of us, it's a very negative story, dude. And it's a lot of self-fulfilling beliefs that will just continue on apace. It's quite interesting without getting into politics, but there's certain politicians that if you listen to what they say, that's how they start. Everything's terrible. It's never been worse, but I could save you.
Yeah.
It's very hero-based. It's not holistically grounded. And this process teaches us to stop blaming and stop the doom and gloom, to acknowledge the realities of the problems, but then to go after something positive, like a perpetual purpose trust as one example.
Yeah. For anyone listening, I highly encourage you to learn more about visioning, read it. It's something I've used, Keely has used personally in our businesses, and it's been super helpful. So I definitely recommend it. And you were just talking about kind of how beliefs and the things that we think affect us. And you have one pamphlet entitled A Recipe for Changing a Belief.
Yeah.
This is a skill.
Part four of the book.
And this is a skill we could all use. What's an example for you? What's a recent belief you changed, and how did you go about that?
Well, there's many that I've changed. So I changed many without knowing that I had them, but a couple really quick, easy ones, some that I shared in the book. One was, I used to have very negative beliefs about therapy, like only people who were really screwed up would want therapy. Well, then when I was screwed up enough to finally accept that I could benefit from it, and I actually used it, now my belief is it's awesome. I don't know why they don't encourage everybody to go. Another one is about journaling. I wrote about this in the book too. Like, my belief was not that thoughtful, but it was a commonly probably held male belief of my era. Like, journaling is like a diary. That's like what I'm stereotyping. That's like a 16-year-old girl would keep a diary. Well, then I got started doing it while I was in therapy at the suggestion of Richard Kempter, who was my therapist. And it's like, I journal every day. It's awesome. I wish I had known it sooner. So those are two quick ones. Another one that's super simple, that was easy to change. But when I teach or when I speak, like, and they do breakout sections, small groups. So my belief was you don't want to cut people off from their breakout conversation too soon. So let them keep talking while they're talking. But Maggie from Zing Train taught me actually the time to cut it off is when the volume's the highest. Because if you let the volume start to drop, it means half the room's already bored. And so you have to pick what you want to pick, which problem you want. Those are some examples. Understanding that the means need to be congruous with the ends. It's not like I was opposed to that. I just had never thought about it that way.
Yeah.
A really big one is understanding that negative beliefs always lead to negative outcomes.
You call it the self-fulfilling belief cycle.
Correct. The negative beliefs always lead to negative outcomes. And so if I have negative beliefs about my significant other, or negative beliefs about a business partner, or negative beliefs about a customer, it's not going to go well. And I'm not saying I'm totally making them in into a difficult to deal with person, but it's only going to get worse if I approach with negative beliefs. So that changed my belief about beliefs, right? And then I didn't even know we had beliefs, that paying attention to them made any sense. And then 2 years ago, after the Power of Beliefs in Business book came out, 2 years ago last month, we approved our statement of beliefs. So booklet that we actually sell it, but it was designed for internal use. Well, this was the belief shift to understand that it's legitimate to tell people these are the beliefs that we expect you to use at work. No expectation to use them out of work. But they're like the intellectual ingredients that we use for our decision making. And if you're using the intellectual ingredients you inherited from your family or the news, it's not going to go well because they might not be aligned with ours. So this is, all of these are shifts in beliefs. I mean, there's tons of them.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of a personal finance writer, Ramit Sethi, who he has a term he uses called invisible scripts.
Yeah.
Our beliefs, we don't even know we have. We're not even conscious where they came from. It could be from our parents, from the society we grew up in, from religious community, whatever. Mm-hmm. But they are often invisible to us until we make them uninvisible. And once we make them uninvisible, we can then change them.
Yeah. There's a quote in the beliefs book from Carl Jung that says, until you make the unconscious conscious,
right,
it will control your life and you will call it fate. So yeah, I knew nothing about beliefs until I started this work 10 years ago, but it's super powerful. We have beliefs about everything, money, human beings, parenting, school, days of the week, coffee, work, and those beliefs are driving our decisions and they're creating a lot of what goes on around us. So I'm not saying my belief that there's, or somebody's belief that there's racism is creating racism, but the point is just, if I approach you with the belief that you're going to act in that way, it's going to increase the odds of it happening.
Right.
If I approach it as there's a real problem, which is I've seen you act in ways that I perceive to be anti-Semitic or whatever, then I might approach with curiosity, or I might steer clear. If I just get in a fight with you about it, it's not going to really change anything.
Yeah. In a recent interview, you said, and I'll quote, many of us will say the socially appropriate thing in public, but in reality, deeper down, hold different, even conflicting beliefs. Often we don't even acknowledge to ourselves that what we really believe in our hearts, or what we really believe in our hearts, because what we believe isn't really acceptable. Do you have any beliefs that you hide or you don't advertise because you feel they aren't socially acceptable?
Well, if I tell you, they won't be hidden anymore. Said with respect for those who have it, I mean, I'm not a big believer in organized religion. I understand and respect people who do. I guess that's in a good way, a belief that's evolved over the years, is it's totally fine for them to do that. And I can be good friends with them and not try to convince them and them not try to convince me. So, but I don't run that in Zingerman's advertising. I don't think it's relevant and people may misinterpret it. But some of my best friends are super religious. It's never dogmatic. It's just dignity in both directions and understanding that, which shows that it's not hard to actually have people who are in your life with different beliefs and different values. The problem is when we try to impose ours on the other people.
Yeah.
And we're not willing to look for win-win healthy outcomes that allow my friend to go to church every Sunday and for me to go to work on Sunday and not to have an argument about it.
Yeah.
It's not bothering me that he goes. It's his choice and his family, and he feels and cares super deeply about it. And it really informs the quality of his life in a really inspiring and wonderful way. And I'm the other way, but we can like each other, and we do.
Yeah, I feel like in America today, there's mutual respect generally still for people who are different religions, or atheists and religious people, or more than starting to. But when it comes to politics, that's kind of fallen away. And it's really hard for people from different sides of the aisles to have mutual respect for each other and be like, okay if you believe that.
Well, I think most people have respect, but I think what gets in the headlines is not respect. And yes, it's unlikely you could announce you were an atheist right now and be elected president.
Yeah.
In a good way, we'll have an LGBTQ president before we have an atheist president.
Right. So pivoting a bit, you've mentioned the purpose trust. I want to talk about the purpose trust, but just more broadly thinking about transitions. You've written about transitions, and in recent newsletter, you wrote about it. You quoted William Bridges, who's writing, I'm also a big fan of,
Yep.
And I'll quote one of his quotes because I think it's a good one. It mm-hmm. isn't the changes that do you in, it's the transitions. Change yep. is not the same as transition. Change is situational. The new site, the new boss, the new team roles, the new policy. Whereas transition is the psychological process people go through to come to terms with the new situation. Change yep. is external, transition is internal.
Yep.
And your commentary was that how we handle transitions will, to a great extent, dictate how well we do at work and in every aspect of our lives.
Yep.
How do you feel you are with transitions?
Well, I'm a lot better at it now than I was 30 years ago. Bridges work helped me understand quite a bit about the tangible, factual nature or chronological nature of the change is related to emotion, but there's no direct correlation to a particular emotion, and that all of us can be at different emotional stages and we can move back and forth ourselves within. So that could be anything from a product that went away to Paul, my business partner of all these years, who I still talk to regularly, but he's not really here, you know, by choice, and it's fine. And I respect it. He's finished with most of his, not all, but a lot of his work. So it's a transition. Like the day that he said that is a while ago, but I'm still in this, you know, there's days like, man, it's kind of a bummer, but mostly I'm fine. So understanding that my emotions can swing and that it's not an argument against him making that decision.
Yeah.
It's the reality. So there's transitions around that. And then as we go through the change around the trust. So our bottom line change process is the recipe for the change. It's a non-linear process, but it's very productive because it involves a lot more people early in the conversation rather than waiting till we announce that it's already decided and everybody freaks out. This is where we all freak out kind of together, which is still frustrating in the moment, but ultimately more effective because when we actually finish, everybody already knows that's where we're going. What the transition work from Bridges allowed me to understand is that we can be in hugely different emotional places. The decision is already agreed on. And so like if you go through divorce, you might know it's the right decision, but there's still a lot of emotion around it, grief and loss that, and even denial, even if you've intellectually, like it's clear that it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. That book Transitions was one of Keeley's go-to resources in 12 month span between mid 2019 and mid 2020, when both her dad died and she sold her business. So it was transition upon transition. And she found that the writing in that book very helpful.
I agree.
So let's talk about the trust. You recently went through the big change in a transition to a perpetual purpose trust ownership. You decided to, quote unquote here, sell the brand, which is really the foundation of the community of businesses, and put that into a trust. And this kind of solved the succession planning problem for you and set up the company for perpetual independence and commitment to purpose. Because I helped a bit with that process, I'm very familiar with this, but our audience is not. So can you just explain what you did and why you did it?
Yes, although you're like the doctor asking the patient to explain their disease. But yeah. So as you know, because there aren't that many of these yet, I believe in 10 years, there'll be a lot more. I think you agree with that belief. But each one, of course, is different. Also, because they're, even though I just wrote about succession yesterday, I don't know that anybody started a business with full succession plan in mind from the beginning, unless it was maybe inheritance or flipping the business. But so by definition, if you get to the point where we were at when we started to deal with some of this stuff 10 or 15 years ago, we had already been in business 25 years. There's a lot of things already existent. But this work for me, well, the conversation started because one day Paul, let me back up further. Rebecca Solnit says, trying to decide where he begins is like dipping a cup in the ocean and taking out some water. So I'm going to back up further. So Paul and I had partnership agreements from the beginning, early on. And we had buyout agreements that either, you know, if one of us wanted to leave, it would go to the other person. And then we had life insurance that would allow us, I always get confused over who owns which policy, but like the life, if I died, the life insurance would pay out to Paul, who would then use that money by agreement to buy out my estate. So it funded the purchase of the person who had passed away. It took care of the estate, the members of the estate, and the insurance would be used for that. So we had that for a long time. So that was good. And then one day, like 15 years ago, Paul starts asking me like, well, what happens when the second one dies? I'm like, I don't know. We have the insurance policy, which we did. The money goes to the city. He goes, yeah, but who owns the shares? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, what? And I couldn't even understand the question was so out there. But his want now and again, he to ask those kind of good questions. And this was one of them. So we needed to figure that out. When we started to work on it, like one of the messages I got was, well, if you're going to sell the business, like people have to pay you out at some market value for tax. Like they're not going to let you just give it away. Who's going to buy it? What are we going to do with it? Simultaneously, one of my beliefs that's probably I don't talk a lot about is I'm not a big believer in big inheritance. And I don't mean no inheritance, but my belief, and you're more expert in this than me, is that it's a big contributor to the wealth gap is inheritance. And that the problem, even in anarchist economic history, was less with the people who started doing the work and made money than it was the third, fourth, fifth generation of people who didn't do the work, but made even more money based on the money from the first person. And so not like I didn't want to leave Tammy some money, but I didn't feel like I needed to leave her all of what the theoretical value of the business was, money, which of course I don't have. Because it's only the theoretical value that I was going to get later when I died or whatever. And I was reading E.F. Schumacher's book, Small is Beautiful, which came out actually 50 years ago this year. And somehow I didn't read it until like 10 years ago, although I wish I would have read it earlier because it's wonderful. And there's a million good things in there, but about two thirds or I don't know, halfway through the book, he gets into the conversation about the Scott Bader Commonwealth in England. And Scott Bader, going from memory, obviously, Scott Bader could tell the story better than, or Scott Bader Commonwealth people could tell the story better than me. But I think 1923, he started his own business. He was an immigrant to England from Switzerland, got a job working hourly, kind of like I did, I suppose, as a dishwasher, didn't really like that, ended up starting his own business. Very quick version, superficial version. The business went well. And in 1953, I think, somewhere in their early 50s, he decided that he wanted to essentially gift the business to the staff and created the English version of a perpetual purpose trust so that the company would own itself, which is not typically able to or possible to happen, and that the company couldn't be sold in that case, and that the benefit would go to the employees. And if for some reason of crisis, they needed to sell it, I think 66% of the sale price would go to nonprofit to charity, so that there wasn't going to be this financial windfall for the staff by selling it. But the idea was to keep it healthy and growing. So when I read that, I was like, this is awesome because it allows it to not get sold. Because even if, as you know better than I do, if we sell it to the employees, it sounds inspiring, but we could be gone 5 years later, give them a really great deal on buying it, and then they turn around and sell it to Amazon because why not? It's hard to turn down the money. So I thought this was awesome. The whole idea that the company could own itself was awesome. And the idea that you could then use that work to frame, in your context, purpose and values as like the bylaws of the business, essentially, was awesome. So thanks to you and Natalie Reitman White, a few others, did a lot of work to create this trust. And for us, it's a little different, like I said, than others, because we have had governance in place, which I wrote about in the E-News yesterday. Be 30 years next year that we've been running the organization by consensus of the partners. So for us, that governance will continue apace. That's where the organization is run. For us, it's only the trust is only in the brand or intellectual property. So it has far less work to do. It just mostly takes in income from a percentage of sales. It has a budget, which includes mine and Paul's salaries and some other things. And then if there's profit, it can be paid out to the owners. And one of the key parts of this is over the next 10 or 15, 20 years, more and more ownership in that will pass to the employees who own a share. 10 years from now, hopefully it'll be 50% plus will be owned by the staff.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. A really cool example and inspiration for other companies to follow. And I like how you gave the history there. So you finished your transition about 6 months ago. So 6 months into it.
Yep.
How is it going? How are the staff? Is there a feeling of change or is it kind of feel the same?
So I have some friends who are working on one too, learned about it from us, having learned about it from E.F. Schumacher. And they have anxiety around how people will respond to it, because it will, through boards and whatever, change the way things are run. In a good way here, really nothing changed today at all, because we've been running the governance the way that we run it. People are used to it. It'll have other issues, but the way we set it up, it's only the intellectual property. So, I mean, there are changes, but they're not like impactful to the day-to-day life of anybody working here today. I mean, they're important. Like if we were going to license you and Keeley to have a Zingerman's product, that would get done by this board, which still includes me and Paul. But so that is different. And we've already essentially gifted, I mean, as a sale, but it's basically a gift, 5% of the ownership to the staff who already own a share in a different LLC. So that'll give them a little more payout in January. Yeah. And then sure, it'll be 5%. So, I mean, there are things happening that are meaningful. Like, it's not like Paul and I left the next day and there's Sergei Peskov came from Russia to take over.
Yeah. For those who are interested in diving a bit deeper in the show notes, I'll link to the newsletter that you wrote right after the transition.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. For me, it many things, and you speak to this quite eloquently without me talking about it, but it's a regenerative way to work. So it allows, like Paul and I will continue to get our salary for, I don't know what it is, 20 years or how it works out exactly, but it allows us to live. So like we're not living literally on the edge, like we're doing fine, but it's not like I got that much money that I felt confident if I lived to 95, I could just live without money.
Right.
So this gives us peace of mind. The odds are high we'll continue to have money coming in. But it's also not like we're just doing what most people do, which is clear cut the forest, take the money and go to Borneo or the Bahamas or wherever people go. In the long run, the organization can be an old growth forest in the community 50 years from now, long after Paul and I and most people here have left the planet. There can still be a Zingerman's community. So this isn't for me just about giving ownership to the staff. It's also about the impact on the community. And so many businesses are integral pieces of their community. But when they get sold, and I know people who are part of this right now, and I see it happening, like they've been integrated into the community. They're upstanding citizens. They're important people in the community, and then get sold to somebody half a country or half a world away. And it's not malicious, but it's inevitable. Like 2 years later, the CEO goes to a new job, or the chairman goes to a new job, and then she's gone. And now the new person's like, whatever, I don't care about that place. Like just cut these costs. And you got people in London making decisions of what to do in LA or vice versa. And it's very colonial for me. And so this work allows us, in my mind, to keep the profit and the decision-making power local into the business, as opposed to sending it further and further abroad.
I really like that analogy of the old growth forest in relation to a business and a community. And as somebody who studied urban planning, I always think about when I walk around towns that have a lot of local businesses, there's a different feeling, a different energy. Most people, like, they realize that even if they're not conscious of that being one of the reasons, they're like, oh, this is a very nice town or a very nice neighborhood or a very nice street. And part of it is going to be what's populating that street. Why are there no vacancies? Who are the people who are, caring about the sidewalk and the street front in front of their building or whatever it is?
Yep. No, totally. And again, I'm a city kid who wouldn't have known anything about forests, but from having studied forests, it's very apparent. And Suzanne Simard's book is terrific, The Mother Tree. I'm sure there's many others, but like the interconnectivity, the amount of good things that come from an old growth forest is huge.
Yeah.
Right. So the shelter for the animals, the microbial activity in the soil, the interconnectivity between the root systems of the trees, the safe haven for the birds, all of the insects that go with. There's just so much, the anchoring of the soil. And so the typical modern economic way is like, well, there was 1,000 trees in the Zingerman's forest. Paul and Ari clear cut it. They moved to Arizona to retire. But we're going to plant another 1,000 trees down the road, so it's a wash. Mm-hmm. But the interconnectivity, the vitality, the literal health of the ecosystem from that old growth forest, the complexity of it, the nuances of it are not replicated by planting 1,000 industrial trees down the block. It's not even close. And so, yeah, you could say we're going to relocate Zingerman's whatever to Miami. but we're going to open a new unit up here and it's not the same, right? And so the relationships, I'm not saying we're so great, but the relationships that people have formed in our business, I just had a staff member who stopped me at the end of another meeting to tell me he's getting married to his longtime girlfriend. They met here at work, had some pretty significant challenges, problems earlier in his adult life that he's recovering from and doing great work. But so it was telling me, like, I mean, just being in this ecosystem has helped him enormously because he was here. They met, da, da, da. You know, so his whole, I'm not saying I said to him, like, you did the work, dude, but it's a lot easier to do the work in a healthy ecosystem. And all of that, the connection to people's families, the quality of the jobs, the people who work here who learn visioning, and then they go to their church or they go to their school board and they're writing a vision there, right? So there's all of these peripheral benefits. And like, we just hired a young woman at the Roadhouse as a busser who the father emailed me, and it turns out he and his wife met at the deli when we were in our early years, and now the daughter. There's so many connections and so much health that comes from it. And that just gets lost when, no disrespect to whatever chain you want to pick, but I'll let you pick the name, but like, nobody walks into one of them and goes, wow, this is incredible, man. Awesome. I can't wait to call my friend and tell him about it. Like, it's fine. It's convenient. It's pleasant, but it's not great. And like, for me, like, nobody goes, you know, that Grand Canyon is really something else. Why don't we open one in Maine? Let's do one in Montana.
Yeah.
That's a big tourist spot. I think like 6 to 8 around the country would be awesome. Like, no one says that, or nobody goes, well, we use the Grand Canyon. Let's sell it to China and we'll take the money and they can do whatever they want, make it into a swimming pool. It's this awesome institution, this awesome natural wonder. And I think that businesses can be like that. And it doesn't have to be as big as we have, or it could be bigger, but the same idea that it can be left into the community in a way that the owner's not going in the poorhouse, but also that all the wealth isn't extracted and shipped half a country away.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful vision. It's so great that now there is a framework that is becoming more popular for people to actually manifest that vision. When you were talking, it just reminded me of Seth Godin, who likes to say, you know, patina on patina on patina. And Zingerman's definitely has a lot of patina. And I think that when you clear cut the forest, so to speak, you lose that. Switching gears really quick, and I know we're sadly running out of time here. We can do
another one, man.
That's we'll do a part two. I have so many more questions, but one I have bolded here on my sheet because I'm curious. What is the energy crisis facing the American workplace, and how do we fix it?
Well, so in the Yellow Book, there's an essay called 12 Natural Laws of Business. And when that book came out, which is now, I don't know, 12 or 13 or something years ago, I was asked to speak at the Inc. Magazine conference, which that year was in Washington, D.C., on the natural laws of business. And the natural laws of business are, in my estimation, like gravity. They just are true. And Paul had originally talked about the idea of them in a looser format. And I took his idea and expanded it into these 12. There's actually 12 more that I've written in that book, but regardless, they're like gravity. So why do I say they're natural laws? Because I heard the exact same themes, behaviors, beliefs from great athletes, great military leaders, great religious leaders, anarchist leaders, school teachers, poets. Like, they all say basically the same things in their own words, but they all say the same thing. So I'm like, it's a natural law. When General McChrystal is saying the same thing as Emma Goldman, whatever, Joakim Noah or Michael Jordan is saying the same thing as Allen Ginsberg, like, they don't even know who each other are half the time. The themes are the same. So anyway, I was going to speak on natural laws of business. The guy who spoke before me, who you likely know of, has since retired, Gary Hershberg from Stonyfield Yogurt. I hate PowerPoint. He loved PowerPoint, clearly, because he had like a million slides with all these graphic effects and everything. And he gave a very good talk on climate change, which I know definitely not an issue, but he gave a very good talk on what Stonyfield Yogurt is, which he was the CEO of at the time, was doing systemically to reduce their carbon footprint, et cetera. And so I'm watching his talk and I'm thinking, like, what he's talking about is basically we're human beings have created an energy crisis, a resource crisis on the planet, violating nature. I assume anybody who's listening to this agrees with that. It's worse now than when he was talking about it. But anyway, when I speak at conferences like that, I try to pull threads out of the previous speaker's talk to make a more coherent learning day for the audience. So it's not just this disjointed set of talks. And so I was just sitting there taking notes on Gary's talk, and I was learning a lot, and I was thinking about it. I'm like, oh, you know, holy cow, like he's talking about an energy crisis on the workplace from violating nature. And when you violate the natural laws of business, you create a corollary comparable energy crisis in the workplace. What's it look like? We see it every day. Apathy, disengagement, cynicism. Hopefully here we don't have it. I mean, we all have bad days, but hopefully here in a healthy ecosystem where you honor the natural laws of business, you tap the natural positive energy of human beings, but in a setting where people feel where there's no vision. They don't believe in the products and services they're selling. Their financial situation is poor. Their leader treats them badly, like we talked about earlier. Instead of giving them service, they get treated like they're the servant. They don't get good training, so they're not clear on what's expected. On and on and on. Then you get an energy crisis, and the energy crisis shows up in all those surveys you've seen, and most people listen to this have seen, whatever, 22% engaged or whatever. And the irony is that many of those people are paid more than I'm paid. Like, there's people, big corporate jobs with big salaries, but they still don't believe in what they're doing.
Yeah.
So the energy crisis comes from violating the natural laws of business. It comes from violating human nature. What can you do about it? Live the natural laws of business and honor people for who they are, which can be described also as diversity, equity, and inclusion. But it's a basic concept to me, in a great way, basic concept that's hard to find, but important to do, which is treating everybody with dignity.
Yeah. In order to show up as a colleague, as a leader, and treat people with dignity, you need to have your energy, your head in the game in the right place. I've heard you say that you're an introvert.
I am.
You've mentioned some practices such as journaling and therapy. Are there?
Yes.
How do you keep your head in the game? How do you manage your own energy?
Well, I write a lot about that in part three and part two. I just use a quote. The Buddhist monk Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, who came from Japan to San Francisco in the early part of the 20th century, find you the quote because I just use it in my weekly note to the staff. He said, if you want to see virtue, you have to have a calm mind. So that's kind of what you're saying. There's many things I do. I journal every morning. I run slowly by myself every afternoon. I'll be going home to do that after we're done. And then I cook in some form every night late because I don't get home, and we have a lot of dogs, and Tammy farms in the evening, not during the morning, and cook something and eat a good meal every night. So those three things keep me grounded. There's other techniques like that one that I call SBA. I like acronyms I can remember. So this stands for stop, breathe, and appreciate. So when I feel my energy going in the tank, which is not hard to have happen, like a big customer complaint, or as we talk right now, the roadhouse has been out of power since Wednesday afternoon from a big storm. They keep moving back the date that the power's coming on. Like, it's difficult, speaking of energy. So there's always things that are going awry. And as I became more conscious of this, then it was like, if my energy is bad, I'm putting bad energy into the literal room or into the organizational room. With email, you can send it all over the world with social media in 5 seconds. People do it on Twitter all the time or whatever. But if I put bad energy out, we know from physics, it just doesn't go anywhere. It just bounces around and it won't go away. So I realized I needed to fix my energy quickly in order to not have that happen. So SBA, stop, breathe. So like one nice, mindful, deep breath, and then appreciate. And it has to be real, not bullshit appreciation. So it could be me telling Tammy something that I appreciate that she's done at home. It could be just appreciating the bread baker for how good the baguettes were yesterday. They were actually really good, particularly good. You know, it's little stuff. It could be appreciating a client, a customer. It has to be heartfelt, not made up. But I guarantee in under 60 seconds, which is literally all it takes, my energy shifts. So if you think of how much, like if my energy sucks between emails, personal interactions, and meetings over the course of the day, I might touch a lot of the 700 people who work here. I mean, I might not even see them, but like if I am rude to you and you go back to your team, that energy is going to carry through unless you're super grounded. So this simple 60-second investment could save so much stress.
SBA. Yeah. I'm writing that down. I'm taking that for sure.
There's more in part three of the book, which is on managing ourselves.
So just a couple more questions here before we wrap up. One, if you haven't noticed, listeners, by now, clearly Ari reads a lot. You're constantly quoting and referencing things. And I'm curious, what is your reading routine? When do you find time to read?
Between emails? No, I read in the edges, man. I never go anywhere without a book. Somewhere in my bag right here, I have Wallace Stegner's book on writing, which somehow I never read, but it's very good. I have a whole backseat embarrassingly filled with books of my car because I don't have an office. And I got a house, much to Tammy's understandable frustration right now, that's stacked with books that we need to relocate somewhere. But 2 pages here, 3 pages there. Sometimes it's longer, but I don't know. It's like the tortoise and the hare. I get a lot read 2 pages at a time. And I think most people have become accustomed to the belief they don't have time to read. So they don't. But if you read 5 pages every day, it adds up. And I believe it's no different than any other skill. If you don't practice it, you're out of shape and doesn't make you a bad person. And you might be super in shape at something else. But it's just being around the books. Ironically, Emma Goldman, they always said, never went anywhere without a book, because in case she got arrested, she wanted to have something to read in jail. And I'm like, that's hilarious, because I also never go anywhere without a book. And when I go into meetings that I'm super anxious about, I always bring 3 or 4 books with me, just because I feel safer with the books. And that is my awkward introvert. Like, I'm most comfortable by myself with a book.
Yeah. So one of the things that impresses me when I have been reading and you're inserting quotes, it's not even how much you read, but it's what you read. And you're constantly quoting from books that are either really old or they're not mainstream. Yeah. In a world of basically infinite options, how do you decide what to read next?
I don't know, man. The Google algorithm. Well, every book I read, I order like 4 more books, and then I have them in the stacks. And I just, like, when it's time, I go like, oh, this looks good, let's read this. But sometimes I come up on like a situation or a topic that I know I want to look at. So I might start doing that. There is the upside of Google and being on the web, because I can look up stuff quickly that in the old days, I would need to go to the library, the bookstore, wait for the book to come. So I can check realities and find things much more quickly than I used to be able to do. But like, if you, whoever says it, that like your life is dictated to a great extent by the people you spend the most time with, that's also true for books. So like, I'm surrounded all the time by Seth Godin, Emma Goldman. I'm reading David Montgomery's book on soil. It's awesome. I'm reading Charles Eisenstein's book about, I forget what the title is, Beautiful Heart, but it's, they're terrific. And when I'm surrounded by those really uplifting, inspiring, challenging in good ways books, that's my ecosystem. If what I'm putting into my ecosystem is being angry at the news all day, not like I don't look at the news, but if all I do is do that in a not terrible way, and I can be guilty of it too, like, it allows us to never really pay deep attention to learning something new, because every 5 seconds there's something else you can look at. But it's not like I never look either, but it's all going in your ecosystem. So if like what you're putting in your body is a lot of fast food, it may be fine while you're eating it, but we all know it's not going to keep us healthy. If we're taking in mostly intellectual fast food, which when they go like 3 minute reading time, 3 minutes, I'm like, you're running a $10 million business and all you have time for is 3 minutes to read an article. Like, come on. So it's really understanding that the quality of what we put into our internal ecosystem is having enormous impact. And then, like, if I don't put good stuff in, then I don't feel good. And if I don't feel good, then I act out more. And when I act out more, I create a lot of negativity. And then I need to spend more time fixing things that I could have avoided creating in the first place, right? So going back to Amazon in a funny way, that's not funny at all. I was reading an article, not in a book, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, some town in Kansas, that like how they were generating all these tax breaks to try to entice Amazon to come and open their warehouse there to reinvigorate the local economy. And da, da, da. I'm like, y'all would have just 20 years ago not bought all that stuff off of Amazon to save money. Then you would have not put all those businesses that were in the town out of business. And then you wouldn't be giving away the tax break to the biggest company in the country to come and bring you back the jobs that you already had before you saved so much money.
Yes.
It doesn't make sense. And this same thing happens like in the food world too. So, and my friend Justin Rashid from American Spoon Foods, which opened the same year we did in 1982, taught me this a long time ago. So we're in Michigan, right? Cherries, big item. Dried cherries became a big item here many years ago. So naturally dried cherries are not super sweet. So the market wanted a sweeter cherry. So they start to infuse sugar syrup into the cherries to make them sweeter. Well, then guess what happens? Then they stick together. So Then they put vegetable oil on the cherries in order to keep them from sticking together. Then the oil goes rancid. So then they put preservatives in them. It's just like you do all this work to get back to where you were in the first place, but you could have just skipped all those things. So if I can just self-manage, which I don't get right every day, to not stick my foot in my mouth and piss people off left and right when I don't need to, it saves a lot of time that could go into answering emails from people like you and Adam Grant and Seth Godin and thinking about Emma Goldman and talking to Keeley Tillotson about peanut butter.
Is there a book or books besides your own that you most often gift or recommend?
Well, we both like Seth Godin. And so I think any of Seth's books would be very good. The new one is awesome. Practice was awesome and definitely speaks to Stephen Pressfield's work on the war of art and what I've experienced also, which is you got to just do it and worrying about it. But speaking of writing, Brenda Uhland, Uhland, in 1937 or 38, wrote a book called If You Want to Write. She was lived in Minneapolis. That book changed my life. I recommend it all the time to anybody who wants to learn to write. Peter Block's books, which I referenced quite a bit on stewardship, manager, I think are awesome. Certainly Emma Goldman's book, Anarchism and Other Essays, is great if people like obscure stuff like anarchism. Gustav Landauer's is a book of Gustav Landauer's writings that a guy named Gabriel Kuhn translated from German so people like me who don't speak German could read it, is wonderful. Rebecca Solnit's books I like a lot. What's it called? Art of Being Lost, maybe. All her stuff is quite good.
Yeah.
Those are some quick ones. Email me, I can send you more in a heartbeat.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent list. Okay, well, two more kind of rapid fire questions here. What's your favorite place to eat or a favorite place to eat in Ann Arbor that's not Zingerman's?
My house.
Your house. So yeah, you said you cook every night. So what's...
You don't go out.
What's a good recipe you've cooked recently? Something memorable and delicious.
Well, I write about stuff in the E-News, but last night I'm going to write about it, I think. But so there's a dish that became very common American Jewish community that I need to think about the current understanding of the name, but it was called Farmer's Chop Suey. Chop Suey, of course, was a made-up name in order to sell more traditional Chinese dishes into an American mindset. But anyway, it has nothing to do with Chinese food or anything remotely, but basically fresh vegetables with cream, with cottage cheese.
Okay.
And Tammy is a farmer and she brought some, she's growing all these great cucumbers, some really wonderful traditional Korean seed varieties for Jihei Kim, who's our partner at Miss Kim, which is our little amazing Korean restaurant. And she's starting to get her tomatoes in. So so those were on the counter and I had bought cottage cheese from a brand that I actually like. And I was like, you know what? This is super simple and I'm going to make this. And just a little bit of good sea salt, really great telecherry pepper from Kerala in India that use at work and also at our house. And I threw a little olive oil on there because I like olive oil on everything. And it was delicious. And it took, and some fresh dill that Tammy had brought home too from her farm. And it's like takes 8 minutes. So this is the philosophy of a Taste of Zingerman's food philosophy pamphlet. This is the whole thing, is the self-fulfilling belief cycle. People believe they can't cook. It's self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
If you do a little homework and you get yourself just like around good books, you get yourself around literal good ingredients. It's super easy to make good food. Like a great pasta, a great olive oil, and great Parmigiano Reggiano, good salt and pepper, and you have a literally world-class meal that's as good as anything they're going to serve in Buckingham Palace, probably better, in under 15 minutes.
Yeah, well, the meal you described sounds like the perfect peak summer meal. Okay, well, Ari, in my final question, in the spirit of SBA, what is something you're feeling appreciation for today?
Well, from the heart, I appreciate you because you did a lot of homework for this, which is great. And then I'm hilariously appreciative that your significant other is somebody I talked to, whatever it was, 8 or 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago in a good way. And I believe she bought all the pamphlets too. And I, that made me happy, but I just try to appreciate the food too. So I don't really eat lunch, but we have these great crackers from Potter's in Wisconsin that are handmade and really delicious. And I have some of that goat cream cheese, which we make across the street at our creamery, and it's awesome.
Amazing. Ari, thank you so much for spending over 2 hours with me today. And I hope you enjoy your run.
All right. Wow. That was a long and winding conversation with Ari.
Yeah, he's just prolific thinker and writer. One thing I loved, and I'm sure the listener picked up on this when they're listening through, is how, well, every question you asked, he would say, well, I wrote about that. And I wrote about that in this book. Or I wrote about that in this pamphlet. Or I wrote about that actually in last week's newsletter. Not to chastise you for asking, but just being like, everything's out there. He's comparable to Jason Fried in that way, where it feels like if he's thought it, he's wrote it. And it's on the internet.
And he knows exactly where it is. Well, that's chapter 4 of the book on beliefs.
Yeah, exactly. And I love how aspirational to me to not only be that organized in my thinking, but also that organized in putting it out there in writing.
When I was working with him on the perpetual purpose trust transition, I would always be shocked because we would have like a 2-hour meeting on some day that, and he would be late afternoon, Ann Arbor time. And he would be in the meeting, focused, and then 30 minutes after the meeting would end, in my inbox, I would get his 2,000-word essay.
Right.
And I was like, you're running the business, you're doing this ownership transition, and you're writing these amazing long essays, and getting it. I was just meeting with you in person. It was always mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. I saw a meme the other day that was like, me in college writes 10,000 words in 1 hour listening to dubstep, and then it's like me now takes an hour to write an email. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of relatable, actually. But I think Ari's still in the like 10,000 words an hour mode. But I was trying to synthesize my takeaways because the conversation was so long and winding, went down a lot of different niches. My biggest takeaway from Ari, I think the thing that I've most incorporated in the way I work and live, is that you shape your reality through your thoughts. He's really like a meditative teacher in that way. And that came up a few times in the interview. But whether it's visioning, you're shaping a vision for the future and you're working towards it by just having it on your mind. Like my vision of 10 years from now is that my business is going to look like this and I'm going to feel this way. And this is going to be going on with my friendships and my family. I've done visioning several times and I think I have a vision right now that I'm working towards more personally than professionally. And it's been really shaping for me. But also he comes up all the time. He talks about his limiting beliefs or self-limiting beliefs, or I used to have a limiting belief around that and I've changed it. Now I have this positive belief. Rather than just, I think a lot of people feel like they just believe what they believe, seeing it as something changeable that you can shape and should shape, as opposed to being like, oh, I just don't believe that. Wonder why.
And realizing how many things in life are just a story. For example, is a story. Money, a lot of people think of money as numbers or facts, but it's a story. It's a story we tell ourselves. And obviously there's a minimum amount of money you need to like live in this world, but kind of above that threshold, so much of it is a story.
Yeah, it's, I mean, so much of it, like thinking about how you think about your business. I love that just the ownership mentality, I think, is so powerful. He also talked about this in terms of what you read in your books. Like he said, I think that books create, you can create your own ecosystem. It's not just the people you hang out with, but what you read, the thinkers you're incorporating. And that really resonates for me because I really notice what I'm reading incorporate itself into my life.
Well, he brought up the saying, like, the average 5 people you spend the most time with. And like, I spend time with Seth Godin, and I spend time with all the...
Tolstoy.
Yeah, all the authors he named.
Yeah, Emma Goldman. But I love that. It's actually so cool because you don't have to go make friends with the top 10 intellectuals of your day. You can go read those top 10 intellectuals of your day, and then you will become smarter for it, or at least more thoughtful for it. And it also made me just want to go delete social media because 2 things he does when he has 10 minutes... is stop, breathe, appreciate is SBA. I love that. Like, I'm going to stop, breathe, and send someone an appreciative email. It literally takes 5 minutes. And, or read. Like, those are both way better than going on Instagram. In terms for the world, for your own brain. Like, I think about what I do when I have 10 minutes before a meeting, and it's neither of those things. And it really could be either of those things. And I think I would be happier for it.
For sure. What other topics or answers kind of stood out in your mind as you listened to the interview?
I think getting out of hierarchical thinking, I think in particularly, I mean, this is useful for all work. And I also think especially for the work we do where we're consultants and we're called in to work with other people on their business, on problems that are, up to this point haven't been solved or they're trying to work to solve. Remember, you're not better than anyone else and we're not coming in to deliver a solution. We're coming in to work with people to create a solution. I think it's just kind of good to always remind yourself that that's of that mindset. And it's a way more fun mindset when he talks about you know, I came up in the interview, which was funny, but like the fact that I emailed him, and I remember what I emailed him about. I emailed him from Wild Friends, which was my nut butter company that sold in early 2020, thinking, well, I was really inspired by his community of businesses idea. I wonder if Wild Friends could team up with a few other natural foods businesses in the Portland area and create a community of businesses here. And I wanted to pick his brain about it. And he called me. And when you were talking to him about why he chooses to pick up the phone and call people who email him when he has a million other things he could do, he's like, oh, I wonder what I could learn from them. Maybe they'll be a client of our consulting business, but maybe they would just be interesting to talk to and I would learn something. I think having that approach is really, again, shifting your mindset to make yourself happier and to have a better impact in the world is always a good reminder for me. Like, oh, what can I learn from this person right now?
Yeah, he's a super humble guy. And I was also inspired, going back to your previous answer, about the idea of big tasks that seem big happening at the margin. So he used the example of reading a 1,000-page book. Okay, that seems really big, but you read 10 minutes a day in the margins of your day and you'll finish that book and you'll learn a bunch and you'll have a good time reading it.
Right.
And I always think about reading personally as a lot of inertia. Okay, I have to sit down. Like, it's a weekend. I have to pick up a book, get some quiet time. I mean, that's almost impossible these days with kids. But like, even before bed, I'm tired. Do I want to just zone out for a bit or can I pick up a book? But it was interesting to think about all the other moments in my day.
Yeah.
Over lunch instead of scrolling Twitter or reading a book.
Right. It is also interesting what we think of as work versus not work. Like, when you're reading a book and you're into it, it does not feel like work.
No.
You want to be reading it. You're picking it up all the time. So it's also just building that momentum. I mean, he's so human, Ari. You know, when you're talking to him, you ask what his personal vision is. And he's like, oh, I don't have one right now. I probably should do one. Like, he's not writing all these pamphlets and saying, I've done this. I'm perfect. I've always have my vision written. And he's not like a productivity inspo guy. He's more about like a mindset inspiration person. Like, this is a way to approach things. Here's how to get more done with less time. And here's how to make more money. He's really about, like, here's how to create a business and a life that aligns with your values. And if you do that, you don't have to do it perfectly. If you write a vision more often than you don't, if you send more gratitude emails than you do grumpy emails, that's really inspiring to me at this sort of messy middle juncture of my life where I have two little kids and I'm just in and out of work trying to get stuff done, to just be like, okay, I don't have to do it perfectly.
Yeah. And that his kind of big picture thinking really became apparent to me when we were working with him on the purpose trust transition. And every company I work with on a purpose trust transition, the founders are not selfish people. Like, one of the reasons they're doing this is because they want their business to be more than just about serving themselves. They want it to serve a greater purpose or the community. But with Ari in particular, like, the amount of times that he brought up during meetings, is this best for the community? Is this best for employees? Is this going to make sure that we're independent 100 years from now and we're still serving Ann Arbor in that same way? Was very inspiring.
Yeah, I thought about his commentary a lot. I forget what town he was talking about. He was talking about a town that was trying to decide whether they were going to stop offering Amazon tax breaks because they were making the city bankrupt.
Right.
But this is, you know, meanwhile, if they had just not given that Amazon tax breaks to begin with, they could have preserved more businesses. And I've just thought about that a lot, of keeping richness in our communities and how important that is to the soul and also financial well-being of communities. It wasn't something, even you and I have done this like purpose trust ownership work for quite a while, you especially. It's not something I've spent a lot of time thinking about as one of the big benefits. I've like, oh, you don't sell out to a big corporation, but the localness part, where you're not selling to somebody who's in an office that's not in the town that you're based in, is such a huge benefit. And you really feel that when you walk into a place of business. You can really feel, is this run by people who live here or not?
And in particular for Main Street establishments, because the interfaces with the community. Walking into Zingerman's Deli is a much different experience than walking into Chipotle.
Oh, also made me really want to go to Zingerman's Deli. I think we need an excuse to go to Ann Arbor.
We'll sign up for one of the Zing Train.
I'm sure we could learn a ton. And speaking of, actually, he quoted Maggie Bayless, who runs Zing Train, quite a few times. And A, I want to get her on the podcast. And then
Just to be clear for listeners, in case this wasn't clear during the podcast, Zing Train is one of their community of businesses that trains other businesses and leaders on the Zingerman's way.
Right. One of her tips was to cut the team off when the volume's the highest.
Right.
I thought it was a great tip. I have been doing more in-person stuff lately, and it's so true. Like, when everyone's talking is when you say, okay, we're done, so nobody's bored. And made me think that we should cut ourselves off But our volume's the highest.
Is our volume the highest right now?
I don't know.
Well, actually, it's not the highest because there's one question which I wanted to follow up on. You alluded earlier during our conversation just now that you have a vision you're working towards, personal vision.
Uh-huh.
Can you say more about that?
Well, we wrote it a couple of years ago. We worked on these together. I'm not sure what happened to your vision, but I have 10-year visions, positive visions of the future, and you know, it's not 10 years later yet. So
yeah, we're going to play V-Farm with our friend Suzanne.
Yeah. And I typed mine, and you guys wrote yours in your notebook. So I feel like that's sometimes the downfall is you lose the notebook, you lose the vision. Yeah, I love reading these because I love the way they're written. And we talked about it a little bit in the podcast, but it's like, it's the year 2033. I'm sitting in my favorite chair looking out the window and reflecting on what a great 10 years it's been. Here's what happened, or here's how I feel now, or those sorts of things. And those are always so clarifying for me because they really come back to the most important things in life when you really think about yourself 10 years in the future. It's like, I don't have the Sunday scaries because I know I'm going to wake up in the morning and make my tea and go sit at my desk and I'm going to work with clients who I love and who have flexible work and these sorts of things that you can lose sight of because you're trying to chase some certain dollar amount or something else that doesn't really matter to you in 10 years. So I do need to go reread my vision. I feel internally like I'm really working towards it based on what I remember from it, but I need to go read it word for word and see how much it still rings true.
Yeah. And to connect dots between our podcast guests, it's not the same, but when you were just talking, it reminded me of Jason Fried's decision-making framework he uses where how would I feel about this a year from now rather than, you know, next week.
Yeah.
And just zooming out. And those are two different ways to zoom out. And his is like a lightweight way and a vision's a heavier weight way.
Yeah, they're similar. I think the vision puts you along the spectrum of not making plans to being very vision-oriented. Like Ari, I think I land more along the line of Ari because I really appreciate the rigor. Even if you take I haven't read my vision for a couple of years, but even if you take it and you throw it out the window, all the thinking you do to write it helps you with that framework. And I think Jason probably does do something like this, even if it's just in his head of like, what does 10-year future me want? What does that look like? What does that feel like? Even if you don't write it down and do it as a business.
Yeah.
Just even doing that thinking is powerful. It's, yeah. In the interview, a compare contrast between Jason and Ari came up too in terms of like how much planning in advance you do.
The cycles.
Yeah. And I love just the wide range of guests we have and their different processes that they use that work for them and their businesses.
Listeners, I will invite you, if you have any follow-up questions or you were confused about anything, we did cover a lot of topics, email us hello@lumogroup.co. And we are happy to provide you with potentially follow-up resources on any topics that came up or point you in the direction that might be helpful. And also, I have to do a small pitch at this juncture. I noted that I did help Ari with his transition to purpose trust ownership. That's one of the things we do here at Lumo Group. I often collaborate with my friend Natalie Reitman White, who works at Purpose Owned, which is another firm in the space who helps on this. And we often work together on these transitions. I wanted to shout her out. So that's just a plug for anybody who might be thinking that they want to transition their business or sell their business or retire sometime in the next 5 years. It's never too early to get started. Keely, is there anything else you wanted to bring up before we sign off?
Random little thing. I love that he shifted his belief about journaling being just for girls, women.
Like teenage girls.
Yeah. That was just a note I had. And I think that's really cool. And it did make me think that I would like to live in a world where journaling is more common across both spectrums. I think it's a great way to reflect. Everything we just talked about would be a journal exercise.
He made me want to journal more, cook more, and run more.
And read more. Yeah.
He's like, that all sounds great. He also made me want to go to his house for dinner.
Yeah. He may want to eat more.
Well, you know, usually you have some like little question at the end, like, what are you reading lately? Or,
oh, yeah. What are we cooking?
Must have one today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a while since our first pod. We could do the reading one again.
Yeah. I guess, what is your hot beverage of choice and how have you been making it lately?
Oh, well, I'm the coffee guy.
What's your coffee making?
I used to do French press. I got into the AeroPress about a year ago because I got it for Christmas. And I think it just makes better quality coffee that's more like akin to kind of like an espresso. So it's more like simulates kind of an Americano. If you just do black coffee using an AeroPress, I think it's just a smoother, cleaner cup. Fast. Cleanup is easy. And I pair it with a Imbrava burr grinder for a nice consistent grind.
And where do you get your coffee?
I've been on a subscription service. There's a bunch of them out there, and I won't necessarily plug or pitch the specific one I use because I'm not like particularly attached to it. But I just like the convenience of coffee coming to my house every 30 days.
Is it different?
Yeah. So that's one thing that's cool about it. It's like the different micro roaster every month.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, the reason I'm asking all these questions, even though some people listening to this might know that we live together, is because I don't drink coffee and I haven't for a while. I just got turned off during my first pregnancy and haven't really gone back to coffee. But I do drink matcha, and I drink Mazuba matcha, which I really love. And it's a local Portland company, and they get all their matcha from a couple single origin farms in Japan. And the founder, Lauren, is awesome. She's like an Energizer buddy. She'd actually be an interesting interview. Matcha is such an interesting world. And yeah, I just buzz up some matcha with my little whisk. And I look forward to it every day. It's such a nice treat.
Excellent. Okay, Keely. Well, thanks for hanging out with me and debriefing the interview.
Yeah. See you back here next time.
We'll see you all next time, listeners. Thank you so much. To subscribe to Uncommon Business, which is also a newsletter, you can go to uncommon.fm. And to learn more about our business, Lumo Group, and how we help companies, possibly companies like yours, go to lumogroup.co. Thank you so much. And until next time.